Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here with us today. A little historical show, which is the way we're going to go. But interesting, fun history, not just boring learning history. Mystery guest, Sarah Bon Harper. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
Sarah Bon Harper, the executive director of James Monroe's Highland. No longer Ashlawn Highland.
That's right. About 2.5 years ago, we reclaimed the name James Monroe used for his home. He called it Highland. And after him, it was Ashlawn. And then with the wisdom of my predecessor in my role, it was Ashlawn Highland for a little while. And so with our focus now on the Monroe period and Monroe specifically, as well as the people who lived there during his lifetime, we thought that the name Highland was appropriate. And I know a lot of folks around here think of it as Ashlawn or Ashlawn Highland. And it was hard for all of us when we first made the switch about 2.5 years ago. James Monroe's Highland may roll off the tongue a little easier than just jumping in with Highland, you know, replacing those syllables of Ashlawn Highland, now James Monroe's Highland. And it really does speak to the focus that we have on that period, especially focusing on Monroe's presidency, which, of course, is the reason the historic site exists.
Again, our guest today, Sarah Bon Harper. She is the executive director of Highland, James Monroe's home. He was the 5th president of the United States, and Ms. Bon Harper will be speaking about him and his home. She is the executive director. She's also a research professor of anthropology at William & Mary. Can I go ahead and talk all about you for a second before we talk all about him?
Sure. Monroe is arguably a lot more important than I am, but sure, glad to get to know you.
We'll give you your props so everybody knows that they need to stick around and stay tuned because of your valuable experience. I have you listed as an experienced leader in interpretation of historical topics to public and professional audiences. Your work taken you to Tuscany, Italy, Pompeii as project co-director, and Burgundy, France as the field director. Aside from those locations, Ms. Bon Harper has also done teaching at the University of Virginia, the University of North Carolina, and other field schools. You've written many papers and reports, as well as earned multiple grants and awards. We're fortunate to have you on the show today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I always like it when people say that, so thank you. So now that those of us who've been around for a while actually know that it's not two different places, Ashlawn Highland and Highland.
Right. James Monroe's Highland is still in the same place Ashlawn Highland was.
Right. I don't need to look for different road signs when I want to drive that direction.
Right. It's still the same place. New signs, same place.
I want you to tell the story of why I should go. I haven't been in a long time. We were sitting out front talking, and you asked me the question, when was the last time I visited? And I put a little thought to it, and I think it's been more than 2 decades.
Wow.
I've been in the area for a long time, came to UVA, stuck around. I've always called Charlottesville the black hole for UVA graduates. I think it's been more than 2 decades.
Wow. Well, you're overdue. I do hope you come and visit. Yeah, we like to say there's always something new in history at Highland. There's a great opportunity for us for research and for new storytelling And of course, the biggest thing that's happened in the last few years is the rediscovery of the president's original main house at Highland. You know, this is a presidential cold case that is sort of unparalleled.
A cold case.
It was the president's home that no one knew had been missing.
I feel like I'm going to see this on 2020 or something.
Yeah, the archaeologist's version of 2020. So the story for a long time, and in fact, our research team found a newspaper clipping back to 1885 that is the earliest indication of the story that still stood when I arrived at Highland in 2012. And that story was that the little house that's there now, the story was that that was a wing of the president's home.
That was there in 1994.
Right.
Exactly.
So that little house, people always knew that that wasn't the full president's house, the presidential home. But they thought it was a piece of it, a stub, if you will, and that the rest of it was destroyed by fire at some point. They didn't know exactly when. So there were several reasons why there were questions around that. And when William and Mary first inherited the property, they set three sets of researchers on that question, biographer, architectural historian, and archaeologists. To sort of mixed results, the biographer, Harry Ammon, said, yes, absolutely. Monroe lived there. He wrote letters from there. We can demonstrate through chain of title and so forth that that was, in fact, his property. The great architectural historian Milton Gregg looked at the bit of written evidence that we have and said, and the house itself, and said, yeah, there are no discrepancies. This is, in fact, a remnant wing of the main house. We have since proved that wrong, but that was the final version in 1975. And then the archaeologists digging in and around the foundations said, well, you know, we have not really been able to identify the foundation pieces of what would have been the attached body of the house. If this is a remnant wing, we should be able to see the other part that it was attached to. And they didn't, but they did recommend excavating in several other places. And so if you fast forward to my arrival, of course, my focus is on research, and my focus is on understanding what do we know and how we know it. And so through a great series of events, we started asking questions and brought in expert architectural historians with great knowledge of Virginia comparisons. We started doing some archaeology and so forth. And one thing led to another, and we were able to identify the completely forgotten archaeological remains of the 1799 main house, which was not attached to this little wing. In fact, the little wing was its own building and was the guest cottage for that main house. And so this is a major rediscovery and new understanding of the site. It presents a phenomenal opportunity for us. When we started asking the questions, we didn't really know where it was headed. We wanted to know the truth, though, and we said, yeah, we'll follow the questions wherever they lead. So the opportunity that we have is to reinterpret a different Monroe building, the guest house, and to explore and fully integrate the actual President 1799 main house.
How do you lose?
How do you lose a president's house?
Because I understand if you're in California and there are earthquakes. I understand if you're on the East Coast and water overtakes a home. How does a house in the mountains get lost?
Right. And let's separate out the two pieces of that question. One is, how does a house get destroyed? And then how does it get forgotten?
Okay,
so how does it get destroyed? Fire. That is the most common cause of loss of houses of that period. And it was fairly common. You know, heating and cooking were all done in open flame, and that's the biggest and most common way we lose houses in that historical period. The question of how do we forget? That's the really interesting one, and I think there are stories to be told there, and it has to do with the president leaving the site. He moved away. He owned two plantations simultaneously, and his grander one closer to Washington, D.C., was the one he ended up keeping when he sold one for financial reasons and then spent most of his time in Loudoun County at a property called Oak Hill. And he no longer lived at Highland then late in his life, and the property burned. It passed through a series of subsequent owners who added on and so forth, and some of whom were absentee farmers. And so, that's one of the best questions and one of the best stories I think we have to tell about the presidency in public memory.
Again, our guest today is Sarah Bon Harper. She's the executive director at James Madison. How many times do people say that? At James Monroe's Highland, as well as research professor of anthropology at William & Mary, as we talk today about Highland and the story of James Monroe. So the house, the missing house, the forgotten house is found. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago?
Yeah, we announced it in April of 2016, having done...
You announced it.
Right, and we had been doing pieces of the research, and I'm very fortunate, and we as an institution are very fortunate that those pieces came together sort of at the same time of being able to identify the archaeological remains and correctly identify the standing house as the 1818 guest house. And the final piece of that came to us in December of 2015 with dendrochronology or tree ring dating. And so then we put that final bit of specialist research into our analysis and planning to change our interpretation, worked on it for a couple months, and then announced it.
Explain
dendrochronology, tree ring dating.
How does that play a part in what you're doing? I can go out, not that I could, but someone could go out and do tree ring dating by taking, cutting down the tree next to the house and saying, oh, this tree is X number of years old. I think people understand taking the test on how old a tree is, but how does that play into the house?
Yep, and you've pointed to the correct first step, which is we all understand and probably playing in the woods as kids understood that if you count a tree's rings, you can tell how old it is, and the outermost ring is the most recent one. So a tree puts on a ring of growth every year, and the width of that ring is dependent on the growing conditions. So a wet year, like the one we're familiar with currently, probably for a species that likes wet conditions, would have a very robust growth ring. And so the pattern of growth rings over a period of growing seasons would be unique. So if you stack up a whole bunch of years and assess their favorability for tree growth of a certain tree species, you'll have a pattern of thick and thin rings. Thick, thick, thin, thick, medium, thin, and so forth. And then when you pull a sample out of a building, you can line up that pattern and find where it matches on an established sequence for your region, for the species of tree that you're talking about. And that's how it works. You have an established sequence, you pull a sample, you line it up, and you can say, okay, that first phase of that little building you have standing there is late in the winter of 1817 to 1818. And that's, in fact, what we did for James Monroe's guest house.
Fascinating. So you announced this in 2016?
Yep.
How long was the work going on for the lost house before you could announce it?
How long had we been scratching our heads about really where was the truth in this? I would say I started asking questions probably in about 2013. And, you know, I'm not the first person to ask questions or even propose answers on that site. I wouldn't want you to think that, you know, this
You
was...
showed up in 2012 and immediately said, hey, nobody did any work before I got
right,
here.
Right. This wasn't year zero. This was, you know, built on, you know, other people asking questions and so forth. And I am fortunate to have brought a research background. And I'm fortunate to have support in my leadership that preferences research. The college said, yes, by all means, be careful, you know, make very sure of announcements before they go public. And that's why it was a long, slow process. My team of advisors, when I brought to them my concerns that this we were interpreting the wrong house, they said, yes, by all means, ask the questions, and whatever the truth is, we'll deal with it. We'll back you up in asking the questions and go right ahead. And so that moment of commitment to the truth from our advisory board was really a key piece of this story. And so bringing all those pieces and administrative and advisory board support was what really allowed us to go full tilt and say, yeah, we're going to ask the hard questions. When you start pulling dendrochronology samples and you get answers, you get hard answers. You don't get it could be between this year and that year. You get a year and a season if it works right. And so there would be no waffling. And, you know, it took a certain amount of courage to say, yes, we are ready to really answer the question once and for all. And we'll move forward with that.
How has this, the lost house, changed what goes on at Highland? Because this, when you announced it, is when you changed and did the rebranding, correct?
Exactly. We, you know, we proceeded carefully in this once we had the final experts' conclusion about the date of the standing house, which is what finalized our understanding that the excavation, the foundations found in the excavation and the standing house were two separate buildings, and this is what they both were. We said, all right, let's move forward with this planned name change. Together with this big research announcement. And so the two will, this new identity will be tied together with the new understanding of the site. And so a couple weeks before that announcement, we arranged to roll out the new brand identity, the new name, that focus on Monroe. And then while we had people's attention, we said, okay, there's something even bigger. And here's our new understanding of the site.
Has your participation, your tourism numbers, have all those things increased?
Yeah, there was a little bump from this announcement, but then I think we're in kind of the same situation as other historic sites across Virginia, where our regular museum visitation is fairly lean. What we are seeing again across these sites is that participation in our events and programs is stronger. So special things that we do, also plenty of partnerships in the community, events that are really delivered by partners, but in collaboration with us and at Highland. Are boosting the numbers of people who come and experience the site in various ways. So examples of those would be, you know, our good friends at Virginia Humanities with the Folklife Apprenticeship Showcase. Now that's there every year. We've had it there 3 years. A great opportunity for us to combine our missions and invite lots of people to experience the site with plenty of space and room to enjoy the great offerings. The music.
Now, is that a specific time, or is that?
Yeah, that's in May.
Okay.
Every year.
Let's make sure to mention these.
Yep,
things.
In May. So keep an eye out for that.
Okay. And you can find it on the website.
Certainly.
Which is
Highland.org.
Okay. And that's Highland, no S. It's just Highland.
Highland.org.
Okay.
Yep. The Language Center Speak holds with partnerships of their own a language camp for children at the site in the summer and at various times throughout the academic year. Alliance Française has partnered with them at times, and
you speak French, don't you?
I do.
You said that very well.
You know, they are able to bring dozens of school-aged children to the site for weeks at a time in the summer to appreciate the property, to use our big yards and spaces, to understand a little bit about Monroe and history. You know, Monroe himself was very international. That was really his orientation. He conducted his own diplomatic conversations in French, something I've never done. And so these partners in the community are enabling us to reach greater audiences. Our friends at Front Porch, the Roots Music School, bring the Tuesday Tunes music series, now a free series in the summer. And these are ways that we are bringing more people to
us. And the Albemarle County Fair.
The Albemarle County Fair. Yeah, the list is so long that you can't actually mention them all. The Albemarle County Fair has been there for 6 years.
But you can go to highland.org and check out everything that's
right.
listed there.
That's right.
All right, let's take our first break from Sunday Morning Wake Up Call here on WPVC as we talk about Highland and James Monroe, the fifth president. We're going to come back and have Professor Bon Harper, the executive director of Highland, tell the story of James Monroe. I want to call him President Monroe, mm-hmm. but there's
right.
so much more to him than
right.
that. I don't want to limit that. And we'll have you tell the story that I think a lot of people overlook. So hang tight, everybody. Okay, here we are back on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call with our guest, Sarah Bon Harper, again, executive director of James Monroe's Highland. For those of you who've been in town for a long, long time, no longer Ashlawn Highland. And why did we do that again?
Focus on James Monroe and his period of history.
Okay. So you mentioned that William and Mary inherited mm-hmm. the property.
Mm-hmm.
And doing my homework, I think I know the answer why. But why is that? Why did William and Mary? We're in Charlottesville. If a university is going to inherit the property, why didn't UVA inherit the property? How did William and Mary end up?
Well, although James Monroe was U.S. president and on the Board of Visitors when UVA was founded, he was a student at William & Mary. And it was really that time at the college that he came into his own, learned a lot about leadership, and then from there went off and fought in the American Revolution. So it was because he was a student at William & Mary, 1774 to 1776.
So tell his story, if you would. I watched some videos. You're a fabulous storyteller, and I think some people who are listening hopefully will be surprised, maybe, because they didn't know, or reminded when they hear all these things put together. Oh, I knew that, but these things that they learned in various grades in school are put back together in the next few minutes as you tell us about James Monroe.
Right. Yeah. Glad to do that. And I'll link back to something you said just before the break was he was the fifth U.S. president, but there's so much more. And he had a long career, about 50 years in public service. If you start when he was swept off into the American Revolution from the College of William & Mary, where he was a student. He fought in the American Revolution, was gravely wounded, one of the few that was wounded at the Battle of Trenton, having been part of that advance guard the night before, before that famous crossing. And, of course, he's the one pictured in Washington Crossing the Delaware, that famous painting, and he's depicted holding the flag. Of course, he did not cross with Washington. He crossed the evening before. And there's a great story. We don't have time for all the stories of Monroe's life, but this one, I think, really sets the stage. He and his advance guard unit were out the night before Washington's crossing, and a private landowner came out and said, "Hey, y'all, get off my grass. Go on, move along." And Monroe and his guys said, "We're not the bad guys." Of course, they thought, the landowner thought they were the Hessians, and said, "No, we're not the bad guys. We're the good guys." And then this landowner said, "Oh my goodness, well, why don't you come on in and I'll feed you some supper, and maybe I'll go with you tomorrow. I am Dr. Riker, and I am a surgeon, and perhaps some poor soul will need me tomorrow on the field of battle." And of course, the following day, who is our poor soul who needs him? Monroe himself takes a bullet to the shoulder, takes a musket ball to the shoulder, and would have bled out there in the snow very quickly had it not been for Dr. Riker and his presence that day. And so from look back and cast Monroe's career, the couple of key starting points would be his education and contacts at William and Mary, but then that moment at Trenton, and of course he takes some months to recover, but then goes on and winters at Valley Forge, fights at Monmouth and several other of the battles in the Northeast. And then you think about this episode of being gravely wounded and having then really solidified a commitment to the American cause. So that Monroe's career goes from that point through highly partisan conversations, probably too polite of a word, but highly partisan conversations about what the new government should be, the creation of that government. He was then he served at state and national levels for decades after that. But by the time he was Secretary of State, simultaneously Secretary of War, and a two-term president, he was he had really overcome some of those partisan strident notes that he hit during the early years. And he came to see that there were causes that were good for the country that weren't necessarily of his own political party. And he really was a unifier by the time he was president. When he ran for his second term in office and he was reelected, he ran virtually unopposed. There was an opponent, but really a not very significant one. And he was reelected almost unanimously in the Electoral College. There was one elector who voted against him. And that elector said that the reason was he felt that only George Washington should have the honor of unanimous election in the Electoral College. And so if you picture a second term reelection so tremendously popular and having weathered the great economic downturn that we call the Panic of 1819, they, in a beautifully understated way at the time, called it hard times, but these hard times were really hard. And Monroe somehow came away from that unscathed politically and was a tremendously popular president in his own time.
He also had several things that, Valley Forge, mm-hmm. right? He crosses the Delaware, mm-hmm. Secretary of State, mm-hmm. Secretary of War, President.
Let's not forget governor of Virginia, senator, congressman.
He makes the Louisiana Purchase during his time.
He kind of gets sent as the closer on that deal. Yeah, there the negotiations having been underway but not quite done. Jefferson sends Monroe as secretary, as minister to France for that moment, and he's able to really push that deal to its closure.
Certainly some key parts of anyone's life.
Yeah. And you know what's really appealing about Monroe as a vehicle for storytelling in U.S. history is that by talking about these episodes in Monroe's own career, we are telling the story of these decades of U.S. history. He's involved in so many critical pieces that it gives us a lot of room to put these stories together and talk about how the U.S. developed and how there were key junctures and decisions and moments of success or failure. And so Monroe really gives us the opportunity to tell so many good stories about those decades.
30 minutes after the hour here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Thank you for being with us today and listening to Sarah Bond Harper. She's executive director at James Monroe's Highland. She's also a research professor of anthropology at William & Mary. As we listen to the stories of President Monroe and so many other things that he accomplished during his time, just to jump to the side a little bit, what's it like to be an anthropology professor? Because the vision is of you on your knees, shagging dirt, looking for bones.
Right. You know, my
sitting at a table telling stories.
Right. My real love is figuring out what happened in the past. And that is why I'm an archaeologist and practiced as one for decades. But the real purpose of that research is to understand humanity. And to understand a lot of different things about people. So I know it's a little bit surprising that, you know, I come in here with clean fingernails and you can look now just to assure your listeners.
So I wouldn't check.
right before I moved over to Highland from a great position as research manager in the archaeology department at Monticello, a position I held for a long time. I was also teaching at the University of Virginia, and I taught in the Bachelor of Interdisciplinary Studies program, the BIS program. And that is a fantastic and creative program that offered me the opportunity to teach courses of my own imagination to really engage students, and BIS is students of all ages, so non-traditional students, and to engage them with archaeology. I got to teach a basic course in archaeological research, which is how we frame research and go about getting answers. And I basically followed my own syllabus and teaching in discovering, in moving us in the path towards discovering that house. I got to teach one about archaeology in today's society, ways we use archaeological and historical data to tell stories that are relevant today. And that's really where I got to explore storytelling and the way we really the key piece is you do your research, right? That's the sort of nerdy on your own kind of, or with a team of other folks with dirt under their nails. You know, that's the, you're getting the data, getting the knowledge. But then what we do with that is really what matters. And so my key piece there was, is you can take the same set of data, the same knowledge that you've created, and tell it to students, to professional audiences, say at national conferences or in scholarly journals. You can share it in film. You can share it at public sites, right? And you can write popular works, either books or articles. And so the real key piece is everybody can share the same body of data if you are thoughtful about ways that you interpret that. So making your work interesting to the public, well, that's exactly what a historic site does, making tales of history and archaeology interesting to a public audience.
What's it like being next to Monticello and in an area with Montpelier right there, sort of sharing the space, the small space, with three of you?
Right. In all the business school courses you can think of, you can talk about the competitive landscape or the cooperative landscape, right?
And you used the phrase lean times earlier, I think.
Well, it is lean for historic sites right now in our regular walk-in visitation. But I think having the presence of these three sites and these three founders and their legacies here really makes this a place to come to explore presidential history. Having Monticello really and truly right next door, just a couple miles up the road, which is paved all the way between us, really gives Charlottesville and Albemarle County a destination. Monticello has been doing great work for so long that it's a big and high quality site. And so we, of course, are glad to be in the same environment and having people come to the area specifically who are interested in history and interested in this period of history and presidential history.
Again, our guest today, Sarah Bon Harper from James Monroe's Highland, 36 minutes after the hour. I want to know, you've been to, I don't want to leave Highland across, but for just a minute before we take our next break. But I asked you about digging, and you had to dig before you could find the lost home. And you've been to Italy and France, and I'm sure other areas. Mm-hmm. Those were just the two I mentioned. I don't know what it's like to, what you had to do in those areas to set up. I want to know what you had to do for the new house to set up. What's it? Because all we ever see are these sort of checkerboard spaces. Why is that?
Yeah. Right. Let's go back to my research methods class here. And it starts with the questions. What is already known about this context, and where are the gaps? What questions can we create that will potentially fill those gaps in our knowledge? The work that I was doing with a team at Pompeii, for example, we were looking at parts of the city that were already archaeological remains by the time the tremendous earthquake, set of earthquakes and, of course, volcanic eruption occurred in 79 AD. There were already archaeological deposits there. So we were digging below the ground levels. At Highland, of course, what we were doing was saying, there is supposed to be another half of a building and we don't seem to find it adjacent. So how are we going to go about looking for it?
And you can go to the Highland.org site and see pictures of what we're discussing.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so I started out with some volunteers digging shovel test pits or STPs, like small foot diameter holes in the ground. Realized pretty quickly that it wasn't tenable for me to actually do that. And we worked with a company here in town, Rivanna Archaeological Services, who actually completed the survey and then explored the archaeological site that we did discover. And it often comes out first in that survey phase of going around and looking, whether it's looking at the ground surface or digging these shovel tests below the ground surface, to find new evidence and going around in a fairly systematic way. And then doing more intensive excavation. Those are the checkerboards that you see in areas where you find something of interest.
Why isn't that more modern now with laser beams?
Right. Why don't we use geophysics first? Well, I thought about that actually and got some good counsel Really started thinking about what that would mean. So we had some areas we were suspicious of, which turned out to be not where, you know, the other piece was, and that's why you do it systematically. And the idea was if we started out doing geophysics, yes, you could get evidence quickly on where there are anomalies or subsurface disturbances, but then you'd need to excavate to find out what they were. And so if you were going to go to that stage anyway, why not go ahead and start with the excavation? So it's a little more labor intensive up front, but you're going to put that in eventually. So we just went ahead and invested in that.
40 minutes after the hour with our guest, Sarah Bon Harper from Highland, James Monroe's home here in the Central Virginia area. We're going to come back and I want to talk about how the discussion of slavery is handled from that time period and discussed today. Hang tight. Okay, back with our guests today. Sarah Bon Harper, also a research professor of anthropology for William & Mary. Do you live on site?
I don't. I live in Charlottesville.
But there is a home. I mean, isn't there a house on site?
Well, actually,
that somebody can live in?
There are several. One is rent, or there are two right now. One is rented, a cottage rented to a tenant. And the other one had been rented until recently. And we are now looking at renovating that, really thinking about strategic use of this house. And with support, in particular, locally from the Perry Foundation, who have given us a matching grant. We want to renovate that house to make it research space. So we have plans for offices and labs and seminar space for that other house known as the Log House.
I thought I had at some point during my many years here looked at possibly renting the house there and decided not to because I think don't you have to park them long ways from there.
Not currently,
Anyway, back to our actual discussion. So slavery at the time, for many people, obviously, slavery at the time is viewed much differently in through today's eyes. But let's talk about James Monroe's how things were done at Highland.
Yeah, Monroe was a slaveholder from the time he was 16 years old and inherited from his father. And slavery was a constant part of his life, both personally and professionally. There are professional political moments, such as Gabriel's Rebellion when Monroe was governor of Virginia, the Missouri Crisis, which was resolved in the Missouri Compromise.
And you have to explain these a little bit,
right,
so that everybody would know them by name.
So Gabriel's Rebellion, when Monroe was governor, was a plot by Gabriel, who was an enslaved man. Let's call him an activist. He was a community organizer and activist. And he was the leader of a group who had plotted to raid Richmond, the capital, and in fact kidnap the governor. There was a huge number of people involved in that. They proceeded with their planning with great secrecy, but eventually they were thwarted. There was terrible rainstorm, something we can picture in this season, the mud and the flooding kind of interfered with the rollout of their plan, and also eventually the authorities found out and thwarted the plot, and Monroe was governor during that time. The other one, I guess I mentioned, was the Missouri Crisis. The Missouri Territory had met all the criteria for statehood and was petitioning to enter as a slave state. And that would have unbalanced that teeter-totter of slave states and free states because, of course, there was a movement, particularly in the northern states, anti-slavery. And then eventually this was resolved with the compromise, the Missouri Compromise, where Maine was broken off of Massachusetts and entered as a free state and Missouri as a slave state, but that limited the expansion of slavery to the west and to the north of the 36-30 parallel. And so really issues around slavery were critical. And because the founders did not address what they knew was an abomination at the, you know, at the time of the founding, and they sort of moved it along. And then it fell to Monroe's presidency to deal with slavery at the time of the Missouri crisis. And you could very well argue that they kicked the can down the road, and eventually it was dealt with 40 years later during the Civil War. Of course, that perpetuated slavery for millions of enslaved African Americans. It also delayed the war that arguably would have ended differently had it occurred 40 years earlier. So Monroe dealt with this issue, grappled with this issue politically, and also held slaves personally. He, you know, like all of these founders, was embroiled in a set of contradictions where he belonged to the American Colonization Society, which was the only really tenable in their mind alternative to slavery, which was expatriating freed slaves to Africa. And of course, I don't say repatriating or sending back, because these individuals were generations removed from a birth in Africa. And also, it was not the same part of Africa that we're talking about. So we're not talking about sending them home. We're talking about sending formerly enslaved people to a completely new environment. So Monroe was a part of that and donated even as president, but he did not free his own slaves, with just maybe one notable exception. He did free one man. But slavery is such a critical part of the story of the early years of the American Republic, and is still so much a part of what we have to face with the legacies of slavery and race relations today, that it's a crucial part of the conversation in our historic sites. And it starts with telling a truthful and fair history. And it continues to relationships and conversations with in all three of the presidential sites cases, descendants of the enslaved men and women from these properties. One of the critical things that I really feel is most important that I'm trying to push at Highland, and those on the team that I work with will recognize that I always say this every chance I get, is, you know, when we talk about Monroe and his importance, we move away a little bit from the biography. You know, an interesting personal story of his birth in Westmoreland County in 1758, his parents and their social standing, his lovely wife, their children, you know, this great story. But we really talk about his political importance, and we talk about the economic situation of his life, of him trying to earn money as a planter in the Upper South throughout his adulthood. We talk about his politics. And so because these are the themes of the historic site, I feel it's essential to talk about the lives of enslaved people with the same themes that are important to those years of U.S. history. I'm very pleased that historic sites now are placing really good emphasis on discovering biographical details for enslaved men and women. And these are precious because they're so scarce. It's hard to find a lot of written detail. So when we're able to gather enough details to understand a person, it's critical for us to share the essence of that person in all their humanity as an individual. And this is a yes and, where I think that's essential. And then we go beyond to take these individuals into the same sets of conversations, the same narratives and themes where we talk about Monroe. So, for example, we talk about the difficulty of farming in the Upper South in the, say, 18-teens and 20s, because cotton is king, and this is not cotton territory. So the tobacco, wheat, other small grain farmers in Piedmont, Virginia, for example, are not participating in the cotton industry. And cotton agriculture in the Deep South, what was then the southwestern frontier, that was the real economic engine at the time. And that was where labor was in great demand. And, of course, it was enslaved labor. It fueled a domestic slave trade of enslaved people being sold south as they became surplus, if you will, in planting here, where plowing and so forth, as well as the softening economy, made enslaved people less valuable here than they were in the cotton industry of the Deep South. And so how do we talk about this? We talk about, you know, Monroe's difficulty in turning a profit up here. We talk about the overseers, you know, being squeezed, trying to, you know, Monroe demanding more production and it not working. But more importantly, we talk about the lives of enslaved people and what this meant for them. It was uncertainty. They knew about being sold south, and they knew about the engine of the cotton industry fueling the domestic slave trade. And so when we talk about their experience, we talk about them, yes, as individuals with names and families, and also in terms of their own experience with this particular economic and political moment.
Didn't I read that there was a project going on between Highland and descendants?
Yeah. So shortly after the announcement for the discovery of the president's home, we received a message from someone named George Monroe Jr., who was who said, you know, I have a family connection to that property. And we started talking to George, and eventually then a mutual friend introduced us to another member of the Monroe family, and we got talking to them. They participated in several events. We shared experiences during the past year, and we've met several times to think about Highland's future, to think about shared research, and really to build a relationship of commitment and shared voice about what Highland should be at the future.
Again, our guest today is Sarah Bonn Harper. She's a professor at William & Mary, and she's also the executive director of James Monroe's Highland. I don't want to get away from slavery. Is there a different tour for younger children, for kids who are taking tours from the schools?
Yes is the short answer, in that, yes, we do school programs. We do children's group
specifically
tours.
For that topic?
For slavery?
Would a guide tell that topic in the tour differently for a school-guided tour rather than a group of adults?
It would be discussed differently in age-appropriate terms, but slavery is a part of all of our site interpretation. And that's another part of the key piece, is that we don't segregate the slavery stories to a different part of our site, that we acknowledge and discuss slavery throughout, both as a political issue and a personal civil rights issue, right? The enslavement of individuals. And so that's a part of all of our site interpretation. We do have some more in-depth interpretation if you, for example, wanted to talk more thoroughly about that, where we have a station where you can drop in and see more research and see more, newspaper, runaway ads, graphs, historic photos, and so forth, where you can explore a little bit and talk to a guide interactively about slavery and its legacies. But slavery itself is part of all our tours, and yes, differently for children than for adults, as our interpretation does vary depending on who the group is.
Okay. Only about 3 minutes left, so I want to make sure to get into augmented reality,
yeah,
because this is something that Highland has done and is sort of ahead of its time,
yep,
compared to the other historic sites in the area that we mentioned earlier. So talk about that.
Well, first, the other sites have great, you know, tremendous exhibits and great quality of programs. We have opted to really forge ahead with this somewhat experimental technology and push the limits of what we can do. As the smallest of the sites in the immediate vicinity, we can say, we're going to try something. We would like to really put our marker on the notion that we are ready to reach out and share history in new and different ways, that we would like to reach new and different audiences, that we want to see, what kind of storytelling is best for our site. And so, we're using wearable AR, or augmented reality.
So goggles.
Glasses. Yes. Yeah. And so you're still aware of your surroundings, and you get added information on top of that. So you're still very place-based, but you witness conversations between historic individuals done in animation. Two enslaved individuals, for example, talk about the building of the 1818 guest house. Monroe is putting pressure on his overseer about production. And Mrs. Monroe, Elizabeth Courtright Monroe, is speaking to the couple's granddaughter about an episode in France some years previously. And so we also explore the archaeological site and really try to focus on areas that could not be better interpreted through the spoken word.
So last minute,
mm-hmm,
what's upcoming in the future?
Right. Upcoming in the future is new site interpretation. The thing that is most exciting is that we at Highland have the opportunity to be a laboratory for ways to interpret the past to new and different audiences, that we can rethink our whole site in one go now with 21st century mentality and recurate, reinterpret, make new exhibits, integrate all parts of our story, slavery, presidential, agricultural, all in one set of stories.
And what question didn't I ask that you want to toss out there for the locals?
Well, let's make sure that everyone listening knows where to find us. Highland.org. And, there's a lot there from book groups to events throughout the year.
And you can go to Monticello, just keep driving a little bit.
That's right. Keep going around the ridge there.
Sarah Von Harper, Executive Director at Highland, James Monroe's home. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And next week, stay tuned because we'll have an individual who's running for the House of Representatives in the 5th District on. Thanks, everybody.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.